Part 3. Later Interpretations. Chapter 7. Robert of Khetan, Polymath Translator of the Quran, 1144 CE. Translation is hard work, never more so than when translating a scripture from its original language into another. To ponder the meaning of esoteric words is to explore the signs of other realities and then render them into their lyrical equivalents. Translators must know that other language, its grammar, its rhetoric, its ambivalences, as they know their own. That is the challenge faced by all foragers of the foreign, those who enter into others' mental space with the intent of linking it to their own. To move from Latin to Arabic is to move from a language with all its antecedents in city life, where roads and houses, irrigation and water tanks, armies and taxes matter most, to a desert life, where tribes are the norm, spaces open, oases the lifeline for survival, and cities but dots etched on emptiness. It is not just that Latin and Arabic have different alphabets and grammars. They also reflect histories and societies even more disparate than their speech and writing. How then can one hope to translate from Quranic Arabic, the quintessential language of the desert, into High Latin, the expressive language of medieval cosmopolitan culture? This form of translation is perhaps the hardest work. It bridges world views as well as linguistic patterns and social conventions. For an educated 12th century Englishman, proficiency in Latin was natural. Robert of Khetan studied Latin because it was the language of both theology and science. But, thanks to Augustine and Jerome, Latin was more advanced in theology than it was in science. The rudiments of mathematics and astronomy were just becoming known in 12th century Europe. They became better known thanks to translations from Arabic into Latin coming out of southern Spain or Andalusia. Cities like Seville and Cordoba remained both Muslim and Arab, while cities that had been recaptured by Castilian Christians, like Badajoz and Toledo, retained links to their Andalusian past. Since the 10th century, scholars of philosophy and the sciences had been working with translations from Greek to Syriac, then to Arabic, and now to Latin. It was to Barcelona that Robert went first, in 1136. There he studied Arabic with Plato of Tivoli before finding the employment he sought, one that gave him the most satisfaction and much-needed remuneration, translating scientific works in astronomy and geometry, and especially algebra. He belonged to a school of translators known from their location in that medieval center of cosmopolitan life, Toledo. Toledan translators were part of a Catholic Christian society that was not neutral about Islam. Hand in hand with converting ancient Greek wisdom into medieval European science was the desire to convert Muslims into Christians. In 1142, when the abbot of Cluny, Peter the Venerable, visited Toledo, he asked Robert of Khetan to lead a team project. The goal was to produce the first Latin version of the Holy Quran. Well, not exactly holy, since in the eyes of both Robert and his patron Peter, Muhammad was a charlatan rather than a true prophet, and the book he produced less than a divine decree. Robert had tried his hand once before at religious Arabic. He had produced an anthology of essays about Muhammad in Latin, entitled Saracen Fables, or Lies and Ridiculous Tales from the Saracens. This new undertaking, to translate a book of signs, also expressed contempt for its human subject in its title, The Law of the Pseudo-Prophet Muhammad. Consider the time of this undertaking. It was a time of warfare between Christians and Muslims. The First Crusade ended when Jerusalem was seized on behalf of the Pope in 1099. Less than 50 years later, Turkish Muslim forces regrouped, and soon after Robert's translation was completed, the Turks took Edessa in 1144. There then followed the Second Crusade, 1147 through 49, and the Third Crusade, 1189 through 92. All had papal approval. Christian support was marshaled against a Muslim adversary. Throughout the 12th and into the 13th century, European Christendom had a double mission: to slay Muslims and to retake Christian lands occupied by infidel Moors. In such a charged atmosphere, the effort to honor the pseudo-prophet of Islam by translating his lies, the Quran, was itself an ecumenical act. Peter the Venerable was more than Robert's patron. He also spurred the Christian initiative to understand rather than vilify Islam. While Peter wanted to expose the falsehood of the Quran, he also believed that one needed information about its content before confronting and defeating Muslim adversaries. Peter advocated battle by the pen rather than by the sword, even at a time when the crusader mentality was on the ascendant. It may seem that most European Christians, including the Pope, had already made up their mind about the evil of Islam and the falsehood of the Quran. Peter suggests as much when he calls, in vain, for Islam to be approached, not, as our people often do, by arms, but by words; not by force, but by reason; not in hatred, but in love. Yet the process of translation had consequences. The translation did find an audience. It was copied into numerous manuscripts, and then, when the printing press became available in the 16th century, not only was the Gutenberg Bible published, but also two Latin editions of Robert of Ketton's translation of the Quran. Blind hatred may not have been entirely replaced by enlightened engagement, but at least a version of the Quran was available in a European language, and some were trying to make sense of its signs. Translating the Quran posed a challenge, above all to Robert's imagination. It was a challenge of a different order than translating scientific texts from Arabic into Latin. Scientific Arabic was not the same as Quranic Arabic. The former was a language that had been developed after the time of the Prophet Muhammad and the first generation of Muslims, whereas Quranic Arabic projected a desert culture, one that preceded Robert by more than five centuries, one that was remote from him and also from his European contemporaries. Robert could have produced a literal translation, and later scholars have faulted him for what seemed to be his loose, almost subjective rendition of the Quran. But this was not the case. Robert believed enough in the revelatory claims of the Quran to consult Muslims who had written commentaries. He consulted many such commentaries, including Tabari's, and while he never cited them by name, it is very clear that he used them, and preferred them to a literal rendering, especially with difficult passages. Simply because the law of the pseudo-prophet Muhammad is a paraphrase does not mean that it is a poor and misleading translation. Robert was trying to gauge what Muslims themselves took the Quran to mean. Robert understood what many of his European successors who attempted to translate the Quran did not understand. The long tradition of Arabic Muslim commentary could help non-Muslims in their effort to move between different languages, cultures, and religions. Robert used Muslim Quran commentaries, whether through translation or by reference to them in Arabic, and he made his own loose translations of difficult words or complex passages with knowledge gleaned from these same commentaries. Some of his best efforts at engaged translation are the earlier, shorter chapters. The shortest of all Quranic chapters is chapter 108, Al-Kathar. Al-Kathar itself is a rare word, often translated as abundance or abundance of good. But Tabari, along with others, thought it referred to a river in paradise, following a tradition on the night journey and ascent to heaven, where Gabriel is said to have told the prophet, "What you see here is the spring of Kathar. God Almighty has made you a gift of it." Robert reflects the view of this tradition, when he renders the verse, "In the name of God, full of compassion, ever compassionate, surely we have prepared for you a fountain in paradise. So pray to your Lord and sacrifice, for your enemy will surely lack helpers and progeny." Chapter 108, verse 1 through 3. The general reference to abundance becomes instead the specific mention of a fountain in paradise. Similarly, in the last line, the Quran simply refers to the enemy as cut off. It does not allude to helpers and progeny. But another prominent medieval commentary, this one by Tabarsi, a 12th century Shiite scholar, does suggest that the enemy will have no children or progeny. And it seems likely that Robert used Tabarsi's insight to amplify his own translation. A similar conclusion comes in considering the final chapter, 114, Humankind, which asks for protection from the Accursed One. In the name of God, full of compassion, ever compassionate, repeat, I seek protection with the Lord of creation, the King of creation, the God of creation, from the malicious incantations of the accursed, whispering insinuations in the hearts of jinn and humankind both, fabrications. Robert of Ketton uses the dreaded name of Satan, rather than the indirect appellation, in his own rendition of chapter 114. Beseech the God of all things that he defend and free you from the devil who penetrates human hearts. Other instances of Robert's attention to Muslim commentaries and his interpolation or expansion of Quranic passages abound. Two from the later Medinan chapters underscore with special force his deep engagement with the text that he has decried as a book of lies. Chapter 22 is titled The Pilgrimage. While it depicts, as one would expect, crucial elements of the Hajj, or canonical pilgrimage that takes place annually to Mecca, it begins with a reference to the earthquake of the hour. In the name of God, full of compassion, ever compassionate, O people, keep your duty to your Lord. Surely the earthquake of the hour is a portentous thing. But the earthquake of the hour does not make sense by itself. It requires intertextual use of a book of signs to grasp its meaning. It becomes clear only when you read it with chapter 99, the earthquake. There the earthquake refers to the final day of judgment, and Robert of Ketton has not only followed commentators, but also made sense of the internal rhythms of Quranic logic when he introduces a paraphrase into his rendition of this verse. In the name of God, full of compassion, ever compassionate, humankind, fear God, for the earthquake of the final hour on the day of judgment is to be feared. Even while taking liberties with the Quranic text, he is making a general point, fear God, into a specific caution. The earthquake of the final hour on the day of judgment conjures the day already alluded to in the opening chapter, when God is depicted as not just the source of compassion, ever compassionate, but also Master of the Day of Determination or Judgment. Chapter 1, verse 4. Robert gets the point right, even though his translation exceeds the bounds set by some literal-minded critics. Robert's sensitivity to Quranic language and its layered meaning is also apparent in his rendition of the latter part of chapter 22, the pilgrimage. The crucial verse is chapter 22, verse 52. It has drawn the attention of almost all commentators and also would-be translators, because it seems to refer to the concept of lapse inherent in the satanic verses of chapter 53, verse 19. Have you then considered Lat and Uzzah, and another, the third, Manat? Are the males for you and the females for him? The sequel of chapter 53, verses 20 through 25, erase the momentary doubt, if such existed, in the mind of Muhammad. But does chapter 22, verse 52, also refer to a hesitation or lapse in prophetic receivership? According to a literal translation, the answer is yes. Never sent we a messenger before you, desiring anything but that Satan did not obstruct his desire. And God abolishes what Satan obstructs. Then does God establish his signs. Chapter 22, verse 52. Yet lexical subtleties allow for another interpretation that sidesteps the inference of misguided prophecy. No messenger has been sent by God but that from his heart, influenced by devilish suggestions and delights, God wipes away the bad and engrafts the good. Chapter 22, verse 52. If the first translation is more technically accurate, the second, from Robert, is more theologically adroit. Not only does he condense the phrases that have God abolishing what Satan obstructed before establishing his own signs, but Robert also makes clear that the initial obstruction was not in the prophecy, but rather in the reflex that preceded it. In other words, even while his heart could not expel Satan, the prophet, prior to his prophecy, is already blessed by divine intervention. God intervenes before the delivery of prophecy to wipe away the bad and engraft the good. With ingenious translations such as these, Robert projects himself as peacefully disposed to the same enemy whom many of his co-religionists were intent on killing. Could it perhaps be that his outward antipathy for the Quran was a ruse against his enemies, opposed to deflect their animosity? In the atmosphere of the Crusades, and engaged by a patron, Peter the Venerable, already suspect for his Irenic views, Robert had to be harsh on Muhammad. He had to denounce his Book of Lies. Yet Robert's careful labor, his use of Muslim commentaries to understand what Muslims themselves believed to be the Quranic message, marked him as one with inward sympathy for Islam and for a Book of Signs. The paradox of admiring your enemy is one not easily grasped by those who have never translated. You may dislike someone or some idea, but still try to understand both the person and the concept that are alien to you. If it is Islam you dislike, and the Quran is the heart of Islam, then you have to resort to Muslims who believe in Muhammad's message in order to grasp what they mistakenly think to be its truth. Though hostile to Islam, Robert was willing to trust Muslim scholars in trying to unravel what Muslims found believable in the false prophecy of Muhammad. This was, after all, no ordinary book. It was a holy book, or so it claimed. As a book of signs, it was the lodestone of truth for the major spiritual and geopolitical rival of Christendom. At the beginning of the 21st century, with religious crusades still in evidence, Robert of Ketton's work points the way to other options for engaging Muslims. Translation can ennoble as well as belittle one's enemy. Since the Arabic Quran is intended to be the spiritual compass for humankind, its directives, even in English, hold out hope for all the children of Abraham, Jews and Christians as well as Muslims, and perhaps also for their cousins outside the fold of Abraham.